91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Get set for summer reverence and some remarkable fashion statements. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Next, it's playwright, novelist, and columnist Cintra Wilson. She's written for the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and the New York Times. Her new book is Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. And there is an untamed Hunter Thompson element in it. Cintra Wilson says, how we dress determines destiny. It can liberate or enslave. Real fashion isn't haute couture, but a statement that could come from Goodwill or Walmart. She casts a cold eye on South Beach fashion as well. Stay tuned. Topical Currents up next after the news.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Well, this hour we'll talk about fashion. Well, sort of. It isn't a likely topic for us, or Bonnie, I guess it's not a likely topic for me.
For you, maybe. We're joined by playwright, novelist, columnist, and culture critic Cintra Wilson. She's the author of a new book called Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. She's written for the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and the New York Times.
And besides the obvious differences, can fashion in, say, Iowa make the same overall statement as those in South Beach or on Park Avenue?
We'll talk about it right now. Cintra Wilson joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome, Cintra.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks
nice
for
to be here.
Thanks for being here. Listen, I'm just wondering, a little bit curious, what are you wearing?
Oh, it's a mess. Let's see. I am wearing a Dayglow bandana on my head and some tinted purple sort of Buddy Holly glasses and very, very baggy camouflage pants, motorcycle boots, and three shirts, roughly.
Did you see my Facebook homepage? Is that where you got that? She must have seen my Facebook homepage.
Wait, Cintra, I want to know what statement.
You so fly.
What statement do you want to make with all that? The boots, the camouflage, the three shirts, the Dayglow bandana?
I like to say that my fashion statement is no.
No. No to anything.
Yeah. Basically, it says no. That
mean,
way
mean,
I don't have to.
You mean unapproachable no?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's kind of a, it's a sort of self-quarantining. I'm self-selecting out of the world.
Okay. So I thought, let's begin with some definitions. I thought, is it safe to say that you can be very stylish without being fashionable? And you can be fashionable to the hilt, but lack style completely.
Oh, yeah. And I think that everyone has seen it. I mean, the thing that I really wrote this book because I think it's very important that people know from some quote-unquote fashion authority that style is your gift. I mean, style is your imagination, and there's really no rules. And it really is not contingent on money. And, I mean, you can always see people if you go to, you know, upper-class neighborhoods who have spent, you know, thousands of dollars wearing the awful thing that they're wearing. I mean, people can always look tasteless in any tax bracket.
Well, most people seem to create their so-called fashions really by repeating others. But what's the spark that makes one stand out, not just stand out, but in a good way stand out, in a stylish way?
You know, the fashion historian Dr. Valerie Steele was really, really smart on this topic. I mean, I like to think of fashion as a language. And when you see a sort of remarkable, eye-catching style, you pick it up like you do a good piece of slang. Like if you hear some spiffy current street slang that you incorporate immediately into your vocabulary. Fashion works the same way. It's kind of like a meme where it's contagious. I mean, like one cool person can come up with some you know, rocking idea of wearing cat ears or something, and then that immediate group of people will see it and go, hey, we can wear cat ears now, you know, and then and then it sort of spreads like a contagion from there.
But what's strange is the one person wearing the cat ears, or not what's strange, but what doesn't work is that I may look great in cat ears and you may look terrible and they may not work for you. So when it spreads like a contagion, it's like being enslaved by some idea that doesn't suit you.
Well, it depends. I mean, this is actually the idea that my book really unpacks, and it's almost metaphysical. It's this idea of, I think that you can pull off anything if you're really feeling it. I mean, you have to own it. You have to inhabit those cat ears. You have to, like, know with every fiber of your being that you look great in those cat ears. And it really doesn't matter what anybody else thinks, because if you feel good, you're going to look good. And there are no rules anymore. I mean, that's the great thing about this not being the 70s or the 80s, when sort of the power centers of fashion were more consolidated, so you could really identify a look of every decade. And, you know, in the 80s, it was unthinkable to look like Saturday Night Fever. It would be shameful and ridiculous. But now we don't have any stigmas anymore. Fashion is too atomized, and you can really, you're free to figure out exactly your own fashion code.
Well, it doesn't seem
and
to
that's
be...
A lot for,
go ahead.
No. Oh, I was just going to say, and that's fun. It's a worthwhile thing to do.
In the book, certainly you're not an elitist. One of your favorite fashion statements was made by a busboy at the Kentucky Derby.
That man was incredible. I mean, he was just no slouch. He was perfect. He was just gorgeous. He was an older man. He was an older African-American man who was actually bussing tables at a restaurant after the Kentucky Derby. And he had these funny styles. He had these wonderful things to say. He sounded like an old jazz musician, but he was carrying bus trays half full of glasses of red wine, and he was wearing a three-piece white suit and a hat and a tie, and he was spotless, and he was like a genie. He just had amazing kung fu. He was spick and span, just delicious looking.
And you said it looked like he tied his knotted his tie like 3 minutes before.
Oh, he was one of those people who just can pull off really casual elegance that other people would, you know, it'd be prom night for everybody else in his outfit, but for him it's a day look.
So, Cintra, which is the case, or are both of these statements true? Who we are determines what we wear, or what we wear determines who we are?
I think there's a bit of both, actually. This is this idea that I try to unpack in the book of fashion determinism. And I kind of came up with that because it's sort of a phenomenon that I noticed happening again and again. Like, if you're going through a different phase of your life and you rely on fashion, if style is something that is, you know, a comfortable language for you and you rely on it a lot, you're going to buy an outfit that's kind of weird for your present self so you can start dressing into your future self. I used to do that. I don't know how many other people do that. But, I mean, if I had to grow in some personal way, one of the ways I would do it is I would go buy really outrageous boots that I didn't think I could pull off. And then I would learn to pull them off.
Okay.
Learn how to walk in those boots.
So faking it until you make it.
Yeah. But it's kind of a be as you wish to seem principle. I mean, you can push it a little bit. I think if you push it too far, you know, you veer onto the ridiculous. And you have to make some fashion mistakes to figure out who you are, I think. And that's okay.
Well, you say that fashion is both fun and brilliance. Can one learn to pull that off?
Well, yeah, I like to say that I don't think that fashion consciousness is as much about fashion as it is about consciousness. And it's really kind of about knowing who you are and then letting your essential personality be reflected in the things that you joyfully choose to telegraph them to others on your body.
You said you wanted to determine if Regent, so you took this trip around to, you covered the country really, to determine if regional policy and political economies were visible in what people wear. So explain what that means, first of all.
Well, it started out as just sort of a wacky notion. When I first pitched this book, I thought, I wonder if you can sort of see the effects of regional power centers all the way down to people's underwear drawers. It was sort of a propaganda experiment, really, because I was noticing that, you know, there's a certain gravitational pull in any city depending on what the sort of center focus is. Like, I always like to say that L.A. circles the drain of fame, and, you know, the people spinning closest to the center are the ones who are most captivated by fame, and so they tend to look really sexy and very expensive. And then in New York, we circle the drain of money, so people tend to look very extravagant. And in Washington, D.C., it's all about power, so people dress for power there. And then, but I was looking for subtler undercurrents too, because I think even in weirder places where it's not so obvious what, you know, people are in thrall of in terms of a power dynamic, you can still see the structure of society sort of reified in people's closets at this very unconscious level. I realized that you get these signals and you kind of passively accept them your entire life. These, you know, messages, various degrees of social engineering. And after a while, it pops out at the front of your brain in the shape of your own desires. You absorb these messages, and then after a while, you think, hey, this is what I want. This is my individual choice. And sometimes it's not. I mean, sometimes you are just sort of conditioned that way, and sometimes I think we have desires that are false desires. And this can make for bad fashion.
Well, talking about that, let's get to this. You say there's a sexual apartheid. So explain that for us. And I'd like to get to some of the regional things that you discovered. Oh, we have a break to take. Wait, hold that thought.
Also, when we come back, she's going to analyze South Beach for us.
Yes, we're going to go to South Beach. We're speaking with Cintra Wilson. She's considered one of the 50 most influential people working in New York fashion. And she is a playwright, novelist, culture critic, and a past columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and the New York Times. She's written Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Fashion. We'll be right back.
And 19 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, of course, and columnist, novelist, culture critic, Cintra Wilson. We're talking about her book, once again, Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. Now, recently, Cintra went to the Fontainebleau, Miami Beach, and I hadn't been there in quite a while. Many of the natives kind of stay off of South Beach, of course, and I have never seen such short skirts ever. And you kind of had some interesting comments about that. I won't get in trouble.
Yes, you go there.
It was profoundly surprising to me. I had never been to Miami, and I went with a friend of mine who had been there before, and she was going to show me the ropes, and we were hanging out having a cocktail on the patio one evening, and I grabbed her wrist, and I said, Amanda, oh my God, look across the street at those spectacular prostitutes. And she said, you've got to calm down. Be cool. Those are just regular girls. And I'm like, no way. They are not. Look at them. They have like long ironed hair. They're wearing like two band-aids and a cork. And there's like these little tiny lamé dresses and these like 9-inch stiletto heels. And I was like, it had all the semiotics of hookerdom. I mean, it was not derived from anything else. It's sort of like, because you broadcast a signal. You are telling people how to treat you because you are dressed as the person that you think you are. And I'm thinking, how can you not be treated like a hooker in that outfit? And then I realized that all the girls in Miami actually dress like that all the time, which led me to this really agonizing question of, what do you wear in Miami if you are a prostitute? I mean, you must have to go, I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Well, I don't know. Do you have any insight, Joe?
I certainly would have no insight on that. No.
Okay. Yeah, well, that touches on Miami. Well, let's talk about the sexual apartheid that you refer to in the book.
Well, I mean, This all kind of was, it was sort of a snowballing idea that I had when I was looking deeply into sort of semiotics of high fashion imagery, psychology, and advertising. And And it was part of the social engineering thing that I think that we mostly suffer from. I mean, it seems like in the last, at least for my whole generation, I mean, I'm in my 40s, we were trained, like, I remember going back to the playground, and I remember that we used to play all together as little kids, you know, like when you're about 4 years old, and then you have different toys around the time that you're about five. And I remember that, I remember being very annoyed that G.I. Joe was the wrong scale to play in the same world with Barbie. It just doesn't look right. Barbie's too tall, you know, G.I. Joe's kind of short and stocky, and it's just, they're not a good couple. They don't look good together. And then I kind of thought, well, that's kind of got to be on purpose. And then, like, I used to reference this all the time when I was doing lectures about this. There's a logo for G.I. Joe Cobra Command.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have to get graphic here for a minute. Okay. It's basically like this red oval with kind of stripes horizontally across it and a snake head. I mean, it's really very much, like, impossible not to identify as a vagina with teeth. And it, I mean, it looks like a vagina dentata. And this is, like, you know, what eight-year-old boys are playing with. And it's sort of like, and this is the great enemy of G.I. Joe, you know, great enemy of G.I. The American hero must resolutely fight this symbol. And it's sort of like, oh, that kind of, I think, leads to this sort of intellectual monosexuality where, you know, we don't get integrated. Boys and girls don't get integrated. We get told that we're different by these toys and by the, like, Disney princess phenomenon and things like that. Boys are supposed to be warriors and tough guys, and girls are supposed to be princesses and married, and they're supposed to get married and have a dress. I mean, I feel like there's the princess dress, and then there's the prom dress, and you might have a quinceañera dress, or you might, you know. But it always, these are all gateway dresses to the wedding dress. That's the big dress, you know, and that's the one to really, really watch out for. And when, I mean, I did all that. I did all of those things. I mean, I got married in a dress and everything, and then I realized it was just crackers. I mean, I had no idea why I was doing it. It was just something that, you know, society tells you to do, and you think it's the thing to do. It's what people do. And it was, it feels feckless and irresponsible to me now, because I feel like right now, I've been, especially since the economy tanked after 2007, I feel like men and women really can't talk to each other. We've become drastically different because we have very warped mythologies about each other that are incorrect. Men have ideas about what we're supposed to be, porn. Women have ideas about what men are supposed to be, our savior. They're all wrong. I mean, I like to say that the, you know, the Cinderella myth is really dangerous, and sometimes that glass slipper still contains a human foot.
You know, it's pretty amazing. You call them the Typhoid Marys of sexual repression. The Cinderella, the Disney princess, and the Barbie. But it has such deep implications, though, because these are the messages that we get from earliest time.
It's really true, and I feel that the divide just grows more and more as we get older. I mean, I feel that we become intellectually homosexual, and I say that to mean monosexual. Like, we can only relate to people of our own sex. I mean, I think you see it a lot in New York now, that where the only successful relationships I know of really are gay. And, you know, it's great that, you know, we have gay marriage now and stuff. But, I mean, I find it kind of tragic that we've become such an alien species to each other. We're not, there was an old Bernard Kleiban cartoon that said one man's mate is another man's person. And it's very hard to be a person if you're a woman these days, I find. There's just too many weird projections.
Let's engage our listeners. What does your clothing say about you, or what would you like it to say? Or do you think you're even immune from that, that your clothing says nothing about you and you don't want it to say anything about you?
That number.
I got news for you if you do.
Yeah, okay. Cintra definitely has news for you if you think that you're immune from it or to it. Our number?
1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. 9576.
Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Does your style represent you accurately? There's another question for you.
Cintra, in the book you say you should represent yourself as flagrantly as possible. Can you expand on that?
Well, I mean, you know, I have a tendency to hyperbole, but what I really think that people don't give themselves that prevents them from being truly fashion spectacular, actually style spectacular. Fashion is just sort of the commercial stuff that comes up. Style is your personal effort, your look, your imagination. Okay, totally forgot what I was talking about. Could you ask me that question again? I got tangential.
To represent yourself as flagrantly as possible.
The thing that I was trying to get to this point about permission. You have to give yourself permission to wear that thing, like that thing you secretly want, that superhero outfit that you secretly crave to wear all the time. I think that's very important, and I really enjoy... I love seeing style in people. I love it when they're showing me themselves. And this was how I communicated with people all over the country. Like, I could really appreciate somebody's shoes because you can see when somebody's really selected something carefully that they really like. And that is, it's magic. I mean, you can go up and compliment that, and then they want to tell you the story. Like, oh, these are so great. These are, you know, made of genuine cobra, and I found them at the Salvation Army, and, you know, they were under a burlap bag, and it was magic. I mean, people have these wonderful things that they discover that are theirs, and then it becomes their signature thing that nobody else has. And that's wonderful. I mean, I think to deny yourself that kind of expression is tragic.
What about for a person who, let's say, is floundering in a sea of just not knowing, afraid to maybe take that step, you know? How do they discover their own style? Somebody who just feels like they don't have one.
You know, I didn't actually intend to shill myself this way, but I do work sometimes as a fashion consultant, and... I have really enjoyed taking people through these transformations because people, like especially women who have like terrible body images. I mean, every woman has some terrible fear about her body and dresses to overcompensate for this fear in a way that dramatically accentuates, you know, like if they feel fat, they will wear these enormous parkas that make them look twice as fat, you know, and they won't like allow themselves to look pretty. I mean, it's like they actually deny themselves sexiness and attractiveness. And so, like, sometimes I have to, like, take girls and say, look at you. You have a waist. You have a waist, and these are your hips. Your hips are not your waist. You know, it's like you have a beautiful little tiny waist. I mean, I have given people some radical transformations, and it is one of the most pleasurable things in the world to see some girl who's walking around feeling like a six and to prove to her within the space of about 2 hours that she's an eight. And to see that confidence grow and to see her rock the thing. I mean, this waitress accosted me because of my sunglasses in Alabama one time. I ended up cutting her hair on the porch of this brunch restaurant with a box cutter and a fork. And then I took her across the street, and she bought all these great outfits, and she was just wearing the most... you know, terrible self-concealing things. And when she walked out the door, she looked like a 40s pinup model. And it was delightful. I mean, it's like sometimes you have to give yourself more space.
Here's Anna, who has something to tell you about. She says, in my experience, prostitutes dress very plainly. As a secretary at the public defender's office, I once attended court. About 20 prostitutes were brought in. They did not look like prostitutes as your guest describes them. They were dressed in jeans, t-shirts, and the like. They looked like schoolgirls.
They were in court.
Young moms.
Well, I guess with the internet, there's less street walking anyway.
Well, and she says, go figure. I guess if girls dress like prostitutes, then prostitutes have to dress like girls. Okay, yeah, you're right. They weren't.
There's a point there. Yeah, but, you know, obviously they weren't trying to solicit the judge, but that would
maybe
be dangerous.
Maybe this was in Miami. You never know.
No, it was in Miami. So what are some other things about the Sun Belt and the Sand Belt about Miami dressing that you saw?
You know, after a while, I was very, very shocked by sort of the amount of skin all over the place in Miami at first. And then the subtitle of my Miami chapter is Nudes and Jewelry. After a while, I just started to enjoy the spectacle tremendously. You'd go to a bar, And there would be these girls, and they would come in these monokinis, like literally, you know, scraps of shiny fabric about, you know, a finger wide and high heels. And they would sit at the bar, essentially naked in thong bikinis and stuff and just, you know, and shoes. It was really kind of wonderful. It was sort of like a nudist colony with slightly more spandex.
We're speaking with Cintra Wilson. She's written Fear and Clothing. Is it unbuckling American fashion or style?
It's style. It used to be unbuckling America's fashion destiny, and then it was fashion. And then actually Allegra Houston, one of my wonderful editors over there, said, you know, it's really style. And she was right. Unbuckling American style is what it became about, because style as opposed to fashion. Fashion is the commercial thing, and style is your personal swerve.
All right. We're on Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls. We have some callers. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Cintra Wilson. Of course, we're talking about her new book called Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. Before we get to calls and more emails, Cintra, briefly give us your views on the Victoria's Secret kind of fashion marketing. I used to see women with this pink stuff written all over their bodies. Thought they were fans of the singer. I didn't know it was Victoria's Secret.
Well, it's very funny. There's a section in the book where I talk a lot about the stores that are strictly about underwear and lingerie. And it was interesting to see that after the economy collapsed in 2007, this rash of new, very high-end underwear stores suddenly erupted all over Soho. There was Kiki de Montparnasse and Agent Provocateur, you know, all these very slutty French names. And then you could go in and, you know, easily drop $3,000 on, like, gold slave collars and vibrating whatnots and, you know, real fur handcuffs. And, you know, it was very, very high-end, very luxury, you know, really nice silk things to have ripped off your body. Or, you know, I mean, and I realized it's kind of like this was the new activity. I mean, I guess people weren't going out as much because they had less money. So they had to make staying at home more exciting. And it was a little pepper for the bedroom. But those were the businesses that were opening while most of the other businesses were closing.
Cintra, we have an emailer, Jen, who says, as a 60-year-old woman, I strive to dress confidently, comfortably, a bit snappy, and definitely age-appropriate. I love clothes and believe your fashion style is an expression of your inner self. We should dress for ourselves instead of the public. But I want to talk about one of her phrases in there, age-appropriate. What are your views on that?
Well, I mean, appropriateness, I think, is your personal elective choice. I choose not to be appropriate most of the time. I'm not an appropriate person. I mean, I don't dress appropriate to my age, and I look tween-isle, I think, right now. I'm dressed more like Justin Bieber than I am, you know,
40-something,
a nice
woman.
Lady newscaster. Yeah, but it's different. It depends on your personal values. I mean, I think that she's probably got a place in society that, you know, she likes, and she doesn't want to offend her peers. So there's that with appropriateness. Age appropriateness is an even more sort of sticky wicket, I think,
right?
Because it does tend to look. I'm gonna get really granular with this and say that I think that the only time that people really try to look that they look really age inappropriate is when they're dressing sort of hypersexually in a way, because there's these really kind of oversexed styles, like the really, really short skirts and stuff. People tend to kind of go, you know, if they see like a much older lady trying to look younger.
Right.
Then again, if the lady's not concerned, if she's pulling it off, it can be fabulous. I don't care. You know, it's like as long as she is rocking it, I think you can also pull off all your clothes and be 60 if you want to. But it's about this confidence level that you have. I mean, you as opposed to brands conferring this kind of magic to people, like people feel confident in Prada or something like that.
Right.
I like to see people who can confer that kind of magic and confidence to themselves just with some weird item. I mean, it's like some of my favorite stuff in the world is things that I found in Salvation Armies and Goodwills and were just weird, and but they made sense to me, and that's what I miss about, I think there was a creative element that was sort of robbed from DIY fashion when MTV came out, because all of the subcultures got eaten, and everything became more about buying your outfit and looking cool by purchasing things. Whereas before MTV, you made stuff. I mean, if you were going to go to nightclubs, we would sit there with glue gun and scissors, and we would buy weird stuff, and we'd retailor things. And, you know, I used to wear a white rubber swim cap sometimes. I mean, it was because it was about what you could get away with and still look cool. And that was such a fun game. It was great.
Huh. Let's go to a caller. This is Nicole, Miami Beach. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I actually, I live on the beach, and I found the comment to be a little broad. And my question was if it's possible for a place like Miami Beach to be sort of stylistically stereotyped because of the perception that tourists may have of what the beach is. Because the community that I'm part of is a very relaxed, dressed, and sort of, you know, hip and almost very beachy. So the prostitute comment, I think that's sort of a perception of what Miami Beach is.
Well, we also had the perception years ago of the Miami Vice style, all the pastels.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I didn't mean to cast any grave stereotype over these girls. I mean, there was a certain select element of, you know, girls going out to clubs at night, and we were dressed much more provocatively than they might be in New York. And I mean, I didn't mean to canvass all Miami women by saying they look like whores. I you know, it was it just took some thinking for me to wrap my head around it.
Right.
That's going to be on our next newscast.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks Nicole.
Hi.
And we'll move along to Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, this is by far my most favorite guest you've ever had on this show for years and years of listening. I really like listening to her talk. You know,
thank you.
I just want to ask her, though, because I have a lot of solidarity with what I've, you know, heard you express, and I get where you're coming from, but and I'm about your same age in the peer group, but I just wanted to hear your opinion on the current controversy with yoga pants in high school.
Mm. Oh, you know what? I haven't actually heard that yet. Are schools locking down and saying no sexy yoga pants in school?
Yeah, that's pretty much the gist of it. I mean, the rule is generally that they can wear them as long as they're wearing a skirt or a skort or anything of that nature. But you know, there's a growing sentiment where the girls are feeling like, quote-unquote, body shamed because they can't wear their yoga pants in high school.
Right.
That's their angle. And, of course, all the, you know, puritanical, you know, teacher types are like, yo, that's way too distracting. You know, so I think you understand that the gist of the whole thing. But, you know, what's your take on that? I mean, you know, I hear a lot of be free in your own skin type of talk. But, you know, there's a time and a place, I guess I could say. You know, unfortunately, there are some sort of things we have to follow, you know, if you want to be successful, you know.
Oh, no, sure. I mean, I also think it's very difficult if you're a teenager, you know, and you're underage and you're living under your parents' roof and you're going to school and you're in an institution because, I mean, since the dawn of time, parents of teenage girls have been saying, not in that dress, you don't. Get back into your room and put on a parka. And I mean, teenage girls, they're hormonal, and they tend to dress provocatively. That's what they're feeling, and the parents don't want them to feel it, and neither do the educators, because it is mighty distracting, mostly for the boys. And, you know, I actually feel like this is a deeper and creepier issue, and it actually ties into the advent of so many expensive underwear stores. And this was sort of like when the economy collapsed, suddenly there was this new thing on the internet, which was free porn. I mean, porn had always been like this premium item, and it controls most of the traffic on the internet worldwide. And suddenly it was free. And that was sort of mind-boggling. And then you actually saw, I feel like I saw society transform to accommodate a more sort of pornographic fantasy version of itself. Like, women started to really, they were trying to look more like anime, you know, Japanese cartoon fantasy, Jessica Rabbit-y stuff. And the stuff that was being sold to them were, you know, the Wonder Bras and the push-up and the thongs and the yoga pants that would sort of enable them to try to live up to this impossible pornographic standard. It's difficult. And I think it gives little girls especially, I mean, if you go to Victoria's Secret and upstairs at their flagship store here, you can find all these like astonishingly provocative little, you know, lingerie sets for preteen girls.
Right.
It's disturbing. I mean, it's like only because like they're not thinking that yet. They want to look pretty, but I don't know. I feel like there's a cognitive dissonance there because we want to protect children from sex, don't we?
It's, I think, mixed messages. I think we get them a lot. Joseph wants to say that he thinks, just like Dwight, he thinks you're very cool and he's a great show.
Thank you.
All right. Hey. We're going to take another break on today's Topical Currents. We have more calls. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576. Lots more to talk about with Cintra Wilson. She's written Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. We'll be right back. David Bowie's take on fashion. Thank you, Paul Leary. Yeah, either and I. I thought it was, you know that? You know that, Cintra, that song?
Yes.
Of course.
Oh, I love that song.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, Cintra and Bonnie. Bonnie, you have an update on our prostitutes in court debate?
Anna wants you to know that they were arrested during a sting operation, the prostitutes. They weren't dressed for court. They were dressed in their...
Oh, they were not dressed for court. Well, no. It seems that they were probably naked when they got busted during the sting operation. They had to put on something in order to go to court. Because I imagine that they weren't wearing that while they were actively working.
We're speaking with Cintra Wilson. She is an irreverent popular culture and political commentary person. She's a playwright, novelist, culture critic, and past columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and the New York Times. How did you stay so irreverent and make it?
You know what? It's been a real slog and a fight. Almost every day of my 27 years in journalism, I've really had to go and just tooth and nail fight to be irreverent, and had to say no. You know, I had to turn down a lot of money. I had to turn down jobs. I mean, people were like, "Can you tone it down?" I'm like, "Don't you know who I am?" I mean, now I'm a diva about it, sort of. I mean, I used to be much more. I try now to facilitate some kind of reasonable middle ground and a compromise, but I really worked hard to preserve my voice so that I would have one, because most professional writers, they get beaten down by, you know, the editorial and commercial leanings of the publications that will print them, to the point where they don't even know who they sound like anymore. They don't know who they are. They don't know how to be funny. And, I mean, people don't like me much because they don't think a girl should be as rude as I am. And, it always kind of boggles my mind, because if I was a guy, you know, women would be throwing me panties. I mean, like, and people would be lavishing me with large pots of money. But, I mean, I really struggle to keep my living going, because I offend a lot of women, unintentionally, but I do. I mean, I offend everybody, I think, but it seems like the women take it very hard because I am not a standard female voice. I have given myself, they think, too much permission.
I guess they don't call you the Dorothy Parker of the cyber age for nothing, right, Syndra?
Hiss. Yeah.
I guess you don't like that, the epithet.
Oh,
okay.
I love that. Are you
okay.
kidding?
Yeah,
no,
it's
I mean, great. I'm very snarky, but I have a good heart.
Next, we have Carlos in Miami Beach. You're on with Central Wilson. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm 32. I was born and raised in Miami, and I find that I didn't really get any teaching in style or anything, and I kind of just learned to dress so that women would not talk to me, you know?
Would not talk to you, okay.
I feel like my mind was never there. I was always kind of wanting to think about something else. My mind never really went into style, so I didn't know if that was something. Maybe there's people that are, you know, style blind, or you know, that you could maybe need some help.
Yeah, well, we might, go ahead, Syndra.
That is sort of a sideline of yours, right?
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, you can hire me. But I mean, I was going to say that even people who don't think that they have a style, or think that they are anti-style, or are dressing to just be invisible, or they're, you know, tech dweebs with Dockers and a polo shirt. It's funny to me, like, how important the absolute choice of that exact thing. Like, people are so selective and so conscious of their fashion choices, even if they're making them to be retrograde, non-fashion choices.
Right.
They're still going to select something with all of their mind and feeling and imagination to represent this thing that they think they're not representing. I mean, I say, okay, well, just give yourself more agency. I mean, it's like you pick out that T-shirt you think isn't a conscious fashion choice as carefully as any lady on Madison Avenue picks up party shoes. I mean, it's guys will not wear things if they think that they're slightly avant-garde for their personality. They get very, very conservative, which means that, you know, you have this very, very slim margin of play zone that you can actually experiment in. I think people are too self-censoring about fashion.
Right.
Anyway, Carlos, you sound like a good-looking guy. You probably don't need clothes.
Let's see. Brittany in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so my comment, to go back to what the gentleman said, my dad is very conservative. Like, he always wears long-sleeve shirts with a jacket because he said you can never trust men who wear short sleeves under their suit coats, because they'll
That's
shortchange
awesome.
You, and they're never what they appear to be on the outside.
Oh, interesting.
That's fascinating. Do you know what the origins of that fashion law are?
No clue. I don't, but that's what my dad said. But I'm a Southern Belle, and I take pride in that. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and I moved to Alabama, and now I'm here. Well,
I love Alabama.
Yay! My fashion has changed since I've been here. I generally wear tailored slacks and a jacket or a cardigan and some type of camisole under it with my pearls or whatever fashion necklace or earrings I have on at that time. Well,
that's so Southern. I love that Southern style. You girls always look so sharp.
Thank you. Well, when I moved here, like, pants that I thought, I'm like, okay, I'm going to lose weight, so I'm not going to get rid of them because they're a little bit too fitted. But when I moved here, it was okay. Like, it's okay to wear your pants a little more fitted. Now, mind you, they're already tailored pants, so they're, like, customized to me. But when I moved here, it's okay to wear your pants tighter. But when I go back to either Alabama or Texas, they're like, your pants are too little. And I'm like, you know what? For Miami style, they're just right. Any other size, they'd be too big.
That's interesting.
It's really true. And beach towns are much more sexually permissive in their dress. They really are. I mean, I realized this when I went to Miami. I realized that I looked like a bar fighting nun because I tend to wear just like black New York weird things. You know? I looked like I was at some strange funeral the whole time.
It's true. My friend from Wisconsin, like, she had only a few pairs of heels, and they were like her dressy, extreme dressy shoes. And she wore like Eastlands or some flat like tie up shoe. And it was kind of, we laugh about it now. We said, you know, it was kind of like Trumpy. But now she owns all kinds of heels. And she's like, when I go home to my family in Wisconsin, she's like, why are you wearing heels? You wear heels everywhere? And she's she's like, yeah, that's what we do in Miami. But they think it's odd, and she thinks it's normal.
No, but you know what? She likes those heels. She's like, I'm suffering for these heels, and they make me really tall, and she feels very sexy in them. And I love that. Like, I always want to go through people's closets and throw away everything that I think is an insult to them. Like, you know, God, those horrible, comfortable shoes. You know, it's like I literally want to burn them. I mean, polar fleece, all of it. I want to take anything that is just sort of like half-hearted attempt at fashion and put it in a large bonfire and just say, you know, God, just get three great things and wear them until they fall in shreds off your body, but put some effort
oh,
into
no.
it.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Well, thanks. It's been fun, Brittany. Thank you so much for calling.
You. Thank you, Brittany.
Uh-huh. You have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And what you want, line four?
Yeah.
Stefan, Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Oh, hi, guys. Yeah, a little short time left. I want to say I drafted Vietnam, came back home, met the Dolls, Mercer Street scene. Have you heard of that?
Central? The New York Dolls?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was playing some music with them just when they were breaking up, and then he became a Latino sensation one hit. Sensation, David Johansen, you know, hot, hot, hot.
I love David Johansen.
So the thing is that at that time, he asked me to join, and the thing is I was a violinist. The thing, I didn't care for that music. I was into more of the musical scene back then. But anyway, the thing is that I was dressing back in those days, you know, doll-esque, Bowie sort of esque, and now...
Were you glam rock, my friend?
Excuse me?
Were you glam?
Well, it's beyond glam. It was like the
Dolls. Did you consider yourself glam? Were you wearing like really tall platforms and glitter
I was
and makeup?
I was one of the few human beings. I must have been crazy, whatever. I mean, looking at back then, I was. And it was just, I was expressing myself. A stiletto.
I salute
boots,
you.
Skin tight pants. I had a scarf, a silk scarf around my neck. And I'm telling you, I took a lot of abuse. and today,
I bet you got all the ladies, though, too.
Well, yeah.
All the ladies.
Yeah, that was a fun time, all right. But today, I have to dress down in, you know, basic black and stuff like that because it's really still dangerous out there for men who just step out
of
line.
Did you ever get beat up or anything?
No, but I've gotten, when I was with a woman walking down the street, I got all kinds of remarks. And also, even today, it's still men, if they want to have the same options and choices as women, they're going to have to get together and demand them, the same options and choices. Meanwhile, there's a lot of suffering out there, a lot of pain and suffering, despite all the trappings of success for men.
Hmm.
Emotional,
it's
psychological.
It's really true.
Yeah.
I think that the less homophobic men are, the more fun they're going to be able to have with fashion. I mean, and you are a perfect illustration of this. I so admire you for being a glam rocker because that is just one of the greatest styles ever invented. And I think everyone should dress that way all the time. But, you weren't afraid to walk out on the street and have somebody call you a fairy, right?
Yeah, no, that doesn't bother me. It's just as long as they don't touch me, that's all. You know?
Yeah, but you were confident enough in your own sexuality that you could give yourself permission to wear feminine styles as a comment on masculinity. That's
exactly
what I'm talking about. That's consciousness. That's badass.
Yeah, but
thank you,
then,
Stefan. Thank you.
Then, back then, men and women were really trying to communicate with each other. And you're right about your
observation
about men and women today.
Yeah, it's really.
And I really think that glam rock is an amazing example of when men and women actually were sort of more similar than they are now, when they could be together.
Well, I wish we had more time, but we've just about run out of time. We've been talking with Cintra Wilson. She's considered one of the 50 most influential people working in the New York fashion, known for her humorous and irreverent popular culture and political commentary.
Bonnie, I might surprise you tomorrow what I wear to work.
I'll be looking for it. I told you
you're
to dress
Instagram,
Natalie
right?
today, and he did. She's a playwright, novelist, culture critic, and a past columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and New York Times. And her latest book is Fear and Clothing, love the title, Unbuckling American Style. Cintra, it's been great. Go get them with those Buddy Holly glasses.
Rock on. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
And thanks for tuning in for the hour. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction with online producer Paul Leary. And more information, photos, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio downloads at the Topical Currents archives page on the website WLRN, whatever that means. See Cintra Wilson on our Facebook page. And tomorrow we have a rescheduled interview with British author, journalist, and commentator Austin Ivory. He's written a biography of Pope Francis, who of course arrives in the Americas next week to visit Cuba and the U.S. He'll be joining us from Havana, where he's preparing for the Pope's arrival. Bonnie, it'll be time to get back to business.
That's right, and that ought to be... I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad he's coming.
Yeah. For Bonnie Berman, this is Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.